if you need me to tell you who that was, then you probably haven't been around for the last 25, 30 years or so.
Who was that, by the way?
I've no idea. Young unknown band. I believe they were on the X Factor. But they didn't get through the early rounds.
It won't be long-haired louts then.
No. The voice of Rick Parfitt of Status Quo. Good morning, Rick. Thank you for coming
in. Sir.
And lovely wife, Lindsay. Thank you for coming in as well.
Pleasure. Good morning.
Nice to meet you both. And, of course, you've been here a while in Spain, haven't you, both of you?
Yeah. I think we moved down here about 10 years ago and found the general lifestyle very nice, you know, certainly compared to London, where we've just come back from. And, I mean, you know, A, the weather, and B, the traffic, trying to get anywhere in London. And it's so relaxing to come back down here, albeit, you know, you don't get the kind of Christmas weather that we kind of like, because at Christmas I like it to be a bit frosty outside.
Yeah, I know what you mean. You know. It's a little odd, isn't it, this? Really? Yes.
It costs a fortune to have all these special effects around the house, you know. Like, snow guns and...
Yeah, you're right about the London thing. When I came here, I had a car which I'd had from new, one of the only new cars I'd ever had, and I'd had it in London since new, and it was 11 years old, and it had done 12,000 miles. Because I couldn't be bothered to go anywhere, because you couldn't get anywhere.
No. Well, there's nowhere to go unless you want to go anywhere, really, is there? Because you only, really, down here, we only basically take the kids to school and drive to the beach.
Isn't that great?
And I mean, you know, wrapping it up, that's kind of why we like it down here.
Yeah, and Spanish way of life, is particularly for families, isn't it brilliant?
Oh, it's much, much better. I mean, we were in a hotel in London having breakfast, and the children were upsetting a couple of sort of elderly ladies at the next table. They were just being normal children. Yeah, but in Spain, we're so used to being accepted in places.
Yeah,
and they made an official complaint.
People don't like having their tablecloth pulled out from under their tea, though, do they? Come on.
In terms of your kind of daily life down here, you did have a period where your health wasn't that great. How is it now?
It's very good at the moment.
Good. I've
been on an operating table for weeks now, which is really excellent. My last operation was a shoulder operation. It was quite serious. I'd had a problem with my arms, and obviously playing the guitar, I mean, you know, you don't want anything to go banjaxed around your arms or shoulders.
Not really, no.
And it went quite pear-shaped, so I had an operation and 6 weeks in a sling, or supposed to be anyway. I wasn't supposed to play for 6 months, and I went and did some gigs just recently, and I'm now 3 months into the op, and I'm nearly better.
You had your heart surgeon and your shoulder surgeon present.
They were at the gigs.
Yeah, so you were covered, weren't you?
Go for it.
Nothing could go wrong.
What could possibly go wrong?
And you're living quite a healthy lifestyle now.
Very,
comparatively speaking,
very healthy indeed.
Healthier than me, I think. Puts me to shame.
Very healthy. I haven't had a drink for 2 years, and I haven't smoked a cigarette for 2 years.
Good for you. You're on those e-cig things.
Yeah. But I find them all right, you know, because I don't know what the general sort of rule on them is. I've never really read up on them, but, you know, I certainly know that there's no tar and there's no smoke. So, and they're the two things that really get you, you know.
Absolutely.
A little bit of nicotine never killed anybody, as far as I know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I puff away on that, and I'm quite happy.
Good for you. I'm pleased to hear it. Where do we begin with a career that's been so stellar? I mean, let's start at the beginning. I mean, I picked up a guitar at age 3, and I've put it down since. You, I guess, were sitting at school wanting to be people like Lonnie Donegan and...
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. Lonnie Donegan. Cliff Richard, and all the bands that were around at the time, you know, graduating up to, you know, Jerry and the Pacemakers, and obviously the Beatles, and but really it was Cliff and the Shadows that got me.
Yeah.
I used to love Bruce Welch and Hank Marvin, and the sound, you know, with a Benson Echolette, because nobody had heard of that. I went off to a club when I was about 11, Winkle Pickers and mohair sweater and all that, you know. And I remember at the end of the night, this was a little club down in a suburb of Woking, where I used to live when I was that age. And they said the band next week are bringing their own echo chamber. And I thought, well, how are they going to get it in?
That's,
you know,
interesting.
Because you see, you visualise, all I did at that time,
the big
black cube, yeah. You know, like... and I thought, well, I'll never get it in here, you know. And I was very disappointed when I first saw a copycat, you know.
A WEM copycat.
But it worked.
Fantastic.
And I just carried on from there. And
did you ever have any guitar lessons, or was it all...
No, never had any lessons. No, I had the Burt Whedon book, 1,000 Notes a Minute, you know, which was...
bless him, old Burt Whedon.
Which was actually, I found it now, possible. Just by plucking the string and running your hand up and down the fretboard very, very quickly, you can do 1,000 notes a minute.
I wonder if any guitar players who've never read a Burt Whedon guitar book...
I've never heard of Burt Whedon.
You're joking, Lindsay. Oh, he's a god to guitar players.
Oh, he was the boy in the 50s.
Absolutely. Was it Play in a Day was his other book, wasn't it?
Yeah, got that as well.
And when did you first realise that you could make money out of music? Because that's a very different thing from just playing music, isn't it?
Actually, at the Woking Working Man's Club.
Okay.
So I lived in Woking all my young life, and I think I was 12, and I was sort of coerced into going into a talent contest at the club. And I went on and sang Babyface, and...
as in, you've got the cutest little baby face?
Yeah. I'm up in heaven when I'm in your warm embrace. And I won a fiver.
Fantastic.
Which in those days was a lot of money,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And went straight to my dad, and little was I to know then that that's where, you know, when you earned money, it would go straight away to agents and managers and stuff like that, you know. But yeah, I was 12 years old, and I carried on playing the clubs at weekends. And I joined something called the MEA, which is a Metropolitan Entertainers Association,
which my dad
joined me into.
Okay.
Where all the agents from all over the country would come and see you once a month. You would do what's called a shop window.
Great.
And I was 15 then. And
early X Factor then, really.
Yes.
Well, yeah, mini X Factor over a pub in London, you know.
Yes.
Very seedy-looking characters in there, I'll bet. But it went on from there, and I managed to secure a summer season down at Hayling Island.
Little
holiday camp called Sunshine Holiday Camp in 1963,
right.
That was. And that was it. And I left home 6 weeks after I left school. I left home and never went back.
Wonderful. And how did the transition from holiday camp to status quo occur?
Well, I left Sunshine. I met two girls down there, twin girls, identical. And we formed a little trio called The Highlights. And again, we expanded the whole thing and we started working the American air bases throughout Europe. And all the northern clubs, and consequently, we got a summer season at Butlins in Minehead, and so off we went. And it was a big deal to get a Butlins summer season.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, in those days, you'd all but made it.
Yeah.
And every week, you know, you had a star turn on. We had Flanagan and Allen on one week, and I actually walked around the stage going stroll.
Oh, brilliant!
With Flanagan and Allen. Not a lot of people believe that, but I did. Anyway, the band were down there in the Rock Ballroom. They were called the Spectres, and we became pals, you know. Left Butlins 6 months later. I went to live with the twins up in London, and we had a year or so, and then we split up, and then the band asked me to join. And a few months after I joined, we decided to change the name to Status Quo. And that was in 1967.
Okay.
And then Matchstick Men came out late 67 and was a hit in February 68, I think it was, yeah.
When was the last time you watched the video of you performing Matchstick Men on the TV?
I watch it every day. I can't get away from it. No, actually, we've got a new CD and DVD out with everything on it.
Brilliant.
And I had a little peek at it the other day, and that happened to come up, and it's a lovely clip.
Isn't it wonderful?
It's a lovely clip.
It really is.
And apparently, I haven't watched the whole thing yet because it's about 4 days long, but there's apparently some unseen footage that nobody's scene on this DVD. So I've got to have a look at it sometime and find out what's on there. But every song we've ever recorded, demos as well, it's all on there.
And Matchstick Men to the Quo sound is quite a leap, isn't it? Because Matchstick Men was a kind of psychedelic track almost, kind of hippie track. How did that transition occur?
Well, the band was initially a rock band. I mean, that's what initially attracted me to the Spectres, because they were just so good as a rock band. And for some reason, Francis was trying to copy Jimi Hendrix's Hey Joe. And with those chords, because if any guitarist tries it, you'll see it's the same chords as Hey Joe.
Yeah.
And where he came up with these lyrics, we were only talking about it on a radio interview the other day in London. And so, you know, where did he get those lyrics from? You know, they're pretty far out.
Certainly.
And they're great lyrics, and Matchstick Men is a great song. It's timeless.
Yeah.
And that kind of got our foot in the door. That got us on Top of the Pops, you know. And to be on Top of the Pops was just, for me, a jaw-dropping experience, you know. I mean, it was just amazing. That was for everybody else. I couldn't believe that I was doing that.
Do you remember who was presenting the show?
Well, it was... and,
no, was it really? Oh, no! Oh, dear!
And somebody else, but that didn't really matter. To be honest with you, I don't remember who presented that show. But it went from there, you know, and the second song, Black Veils of Melancholy, failed miserably. And we thought, oh, God, we're going to be one-hit wonders. And then Marty Wilde came along with a song called Ice in the Sun. And it was a cute little song, and we thought, well, that's got us written all over it. It wasn't so psychedelically... So is there such a word, psychedelically?
It sounds good.
But
there was
a little bit of rock and roll in it as well. You know, it was a cute little song, kind of Bee Gees type thing, you know. So we did that, and that was a quite a big hit. And then Down the Dust Pipe, which was moving towards what we wanted to be.
Yeah.
And during this time of psychedelia, we'd got on the Gene Pitney tour, you know, with Amen Corner and Lucas and the Big Sound and Simon Dupree and the Big Sound,
right.
wasn't it? And we kind of enjoyed that. Gene Pitney was absolutely lovely. I was, again, astonished and delighted to meet Gene Pitney, because I'd always liked him. And there I found myself on a coach travelling with Gene Pitney. Life was all wonderful, you know.
Fantastic.
And you were in a group, and you got girls looking at you and everything. It was wonderful. And then people started telling us how to dress, and that's consequently how you saw us on Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
And we didn't like all that, you know. And we thought, well, you know, these girls, it got down to three one night. We were watching us, three girls, and we thought, well, this is not going to last. At least that's better than three fellas, but we thought it's not going to last. So we decided to take off all this, you know, fancy frilly shirts and stuff like that, and revert back to what we were, and with the jeans and the t-shirts. And this time we'd grow stubble and grow our hair long, and the jeans had to be ripped, the pumps had to be kicked around in the dirt before we'd wear them.
Right.
We went completely the other way, and we were dirty, scruffy, horrible, smelly rockers.
And were your management at the time up for that? Were they all?
Oh, he loved it. He was Pat Barlow, bless his heart. He was a plumber. And he said, you do what you want, boys, you know, you feel comfortable. So we did. And we went back into the clubs around London, but the underground clubs, you know, where everybody was sitting with a pint in one hand and the trench coat on and their favourite album under their arm, you know. And people would sit down, and they were commonly known as heads, you know, because it was a pretty far-out bunch of people.
Okay.
And I remember we were playing the Castle in Tooting, which was there was a room under there where, you know, sort of weird bands used to play. And people were coming up saying, have we come to the right place? You've got Status Quo on here. And they said, yeah, they're going to have a go at something different. And of course, we'd taken on... Oh, sorry, I miss a part out here. Francis and I had been to Germany in the meantime and heard the Doors, Roadhouse Blues.
Okay.
That went ding, 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 ding. And we loved it. We loved it, and we thought, we've got to do something like that. So we started to write stuff along those lines. And that's how the band really found its style, that blues-based rock, you know, all through that song. And, of course, we built this setup of stuff like that. and we went on and played it and just took on this stance because all the audience was sitting down and we wanted to be nearer to them. So we just stood with our legs apart and banged our heads.
Brilliant.
And just hit it as hard as we could. And it all went from there.
Superb. And the thing about, you know, it really used to annoy me when people would say, status quo, they play three chords in all the songs. In some of them, yes, but actually, in a lot of your songs, there's a damn sight more than three chords. And
the other aren't.
There are.
I'll tell you a story
in a minute. And it doesn't matter. If the song is good and the songs over the top were fantastic songs.
If people realised how many wonderful songs have come from the three chords, because that's really where it all started in the early days.
Of course.
If you could play, you know, the E, the A and the B, you could get a song, and then you'd play it in B, but you'd still use the three chords the other way round,
in a different way. Yeah.
And, I mean, in all seriousness, I mean, I've never told anybody this, but we do actually know four chords.
Do you?
Yeah, well, I do.
Yeah? I think I heard you use a minor chord in a song.
Well, no, I haven't got that.
Have you got that? No.
And I've heard there's something called a diminished chord.
Oh, you don't want to go there. That way lies evil.
Can't get
no,
there.
No, don't want to
but
do
no,
that.
we've managed to have, I think, 39 hit singles with three chords.
Well, the country music was always called by Dolly Parton Three Chords and the Truth, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, that hasn't done quite so badly, has it, country music as a genre?
No.
In my kind of early kind of days when I was in a band playing at holiday camps, we'd be doing Tie Your Ribbon Around the Old Oak Tree and all that kind of stuff. Mm. And I, for some reason known only to me, decided we would play Mystery Song.
Yeah.
And so we learned Mystery Song and played it.
Well, that's a funny one to go
for. Very odd
it's
one.
It's an open tuning, that is. Yeah.
Oh, is it? I never bothered with that.
Open G tuning.
That
makes it even easier.
And the songwriting between you over the years, as a writer myself, there's no theory to writing songs. You just sit down and you write songs. But they're great melodies that you guys, and they're enduring melodies, and that's the point of them, isn't it? They really have lasted the test.
Well, I think
time.
Songs are waiting there to be written.
Yeah.
They're waiting in rooms. I have a kind of a visual analogy of walking into a room, and there are all coloured kind of streamers hanging from the ceiling, and they're all notes, and they're all waiting to be... It's whether you decide to walk into the room.
Yeah.
It's whether you're in the right mood. For me personally, I have to be inspired by something. I have to be, you know, think, right, I can grasp that. I've got an idea here, you know. I can't just say, okay, I'm going songwriting today.
Yeah.
Because I might get up and I think, well, I don't feel like writing today. And if I'm not in the mood for it, I won't write.
Right, okay.
And, but if I do happen to walk into that room where all those coloured streamers are hanging down, I know it sounds a little bit far out, but that's just
that.
A mental picture that I see of it. There's a song in that room, and you just got to pull all the right colours in. You know, sorry, I just hit the mic. But you've, you know, a song has got to have the right colours in the melody. It's got to have the right colours in the cording and the instruments you use, you know. And with a good song that you're inspired to write, I think you hear all that right from the outset. I know exactly how I want this song. And the trouble is getting the end product. You know, getting it how you want it, because, you know, you've got five other members of the band or four other members of the band to deal with. Why don't we do this? Why don't we do it that way? You know, so a few years ago, it did get to the point where, look, I'm going to conduct this song, right? I want it exactly how I've written it.
Yeah.
And, oh, blimey, are you? You know, and a little bit of that crept in, you know.
Yeah.
But I can kind of understand that, you know. You want the song how you want it. You've written it. You want it to come out how you saw it.
Yeah.
And so it gets a little bit tricky, but 50 years together, you know, you're bound to get a bit of that.
Well, of course you are. And for you guys, of course, as well, live work was really important, and that must have been such a hoot, being in Status Quo on the road. That just must have been awesome.
Riot.
Well, yeah. We remember some of it.
One Wednesday afternoon, you can vaguely remember.
There's an awful lot of it we don't remember, because, I mean, the the rock and roll lifestyle did kick in.
Yeah, of course.
In the early 70s, really. Up until then, it was, you know, it started off with a cup of coffee after the show, and then it graduated up to a glass of wine, and then whiskey, and then bourbon, and then the drugs crept in the 70s. Albeit we were just, you know, smoking a joint and stuff like that after the show. And then it got to going on stage a bit wonged, you know. And the whole thing became, well, I mean, it was hilarious. I mean, we had such a time. And that's why, I mean, a lot of it, I just don't remember it. But I know that over the years we've laughed a lot.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You know, I was talking name-dropping here. I was talking to Robert Plant the other night, and, I mean, it was the same for them. I mean, they've had such a time, Zeppelin, and which, I guess, tried to emulate them, you know. And I think to a large extent we have, but, you know, there's a good side to it and there's a downside to it. Obviously, you know, I pushed the boat out a bit, and it got me in the end by way of, like, two heart attacks.
Yeah.
And, I mean, a lot of my friends, you know, from years ago, Phil Lennart being one of them, you know, didn't get through it,
sure.
You know. And so I consider myself very lucky to have been to the fairground,
yes,
and been on all the rides, right, and turned the power up and all the lights on, and
that.
I've been there many times,
yes,
and I'm lucky to have walked away, and the fairground's now closed.
Good
I'm
for
afraid.
You, good for you.
Yeah.
How much do you remember of what was an iconic day for a lot of people, and an iconic performance which opened it was Live Aid Day?
Yeah,
I mean that I think everyone remembers seeing you guys open that.
Well, I didn't realise the gravity of it. Bob had said to us, because we were on the same label at the time and we were all in London at the record company, and he said we'd done Band Aid, and that was a hoot. We'd had good fun doing that.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm going to put this concert on at Wembley Stadium. And we said, you're mad. He said, you never pack it, you know, you never get any people in. He said, well, it's going to happen. We're going to call it Live Aid. And he said, will you open it? And we said, well, by this time, Alan Lancaster had gone back to Australia. We weren't really playing at the time. And John Coughlin had... we'd had to sack John because he'd gone too far with the booze. And he wasn't playing very well, so he'd gone. So Francis and I were just kind of sitting around doing nothing. And we said to Bob, we haven't really got a band, you know. He said, well, just sling anybody together. He said, just as long as you're there with that song, with Rocking All Over the World, and we'll make that the anthem for Live Aid, you know. So eventually we said, yeah. And I remember flying over the stadium that morning in a helicopter. Obviously.
Hopefully.
And I said to the pilot, I said, can you just fly around a couple of times? Because I just couldn't believe this sight from the air. And 82,000 people. I mean, we'd never played to that many people in one arena before, obviously, you know. It was utterly incredible. I mean, it was delightful to be part of it, and I know now that if we had have said no, I would have kicked myself for the rest of my life.
Sure.
And I remember before we went on, there was a brass band on, and when you actually, I was standing in the wings, and old show business term, in the wings,
yes.
And I remember, you know, thinking, God, you know, I was so nervous. And by that time, I'd gotten over my nervousness of going out in front of a crowd. And to walk out there was mind-blowing.
Yeah.
To that ovation, you know, to 82,000 people in the sun at Wembley Stadium.
Amazing.
I mean, it was one of the biggest moments at that time, and probably still is, of my of my showbiz career.
I'm sure. How much do you remember after it?
Nothing.
There's some showbiz legend that you ended up in a helicopter with David Bowie and don't remember it.
So I've heard, yeah. Yeah, I did, I heard that. But, you know, it's a really funny thing because I came off stage and I remember doing an interview with Janice Long immediately.
Okay.
And I've seen footage of the interview, and I had a glass in my hand then, and I honestly don't even remember coming back off the stage. I don't remember because I think we were all so excited about what had just happened.
Mm.
And we were going, you know, we were going mad.
It was a serious buzz, isn't it?
And everybody was backstage. Queen were back there. Well, everybody was there, you know. And apparently, yeah, I got on a helicopter with David Bowie. I don't know whether I was invited or what. I've no idea. I honestly have no idea. And where I went for the day, I've got no idea. And what really baffles me is that at the end of the show, I can see myself at the back in a silver sort of lame suit. And where I got that from and how I got into it and how I got back to Wembley, I've no idea. And after that, I don't know where I was for the next couple of days after that. I don't remember anything about it.
How funny.
But well, that's rock and roll for
you. Of course it is, and at the highest level.
At the highest level at that time, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but mission accomplished.
I mean, totally
right.
You
know, we did what we could, and I think, on a serious note, that made us realise that it takes more than a rock concert, no matter how many people, to solve the problem of the third world, you know.
Yeah.
And it has to be taken more seriously on an international level, because a rock concert isn't going to solve it.
Absolutely right. Absolutely.
But it taught us that. But we did what we could and kicked the whole thing off, I think, you know.
Brilliantly.
And of course, awareness.
Most people think that song's a status quo song, don't they?
The what?
They think, most people think that's one of your songs.
Which song?
Rocking All Over the World.
Well, it is, really.
Yeah, well, it is, but it isn't.
We've made it out.
Exactly, but, yeah. You know, yeah. And it's only got three chords.
Yeah, it has, actually, yeah. With an augmented fourth.
Actually. Oh, you see, you didn't mention that one earlier. It's an extra chord.
No, I said it had it. I can't play it.
And what about between then and now? What's the state of play now? I know you did an acoustic thing and you were pictured with your kit off with the guitar in front and all the rest of it.
Yeah. I thought that would have put people off by now. Yeah,
it's a good job you don't play the mandolin, isn't it?
Wouldn't have made a lot of difference where I'm concerned. I don't know about you. the mouth organ, for that matter.
Oh, dear.
Darling.
Is there a Quo reunion, or is that kind of it now? You're never going to get back on the stage together and really go for it as a live band rocking?
Oh, no. I mean, you know, we've enjoyed touring over the years. Probably done too much of it, really. I mean, I think the thing about Quo is that over the last, dare I say, 50 years, we've always been available. You know, we've played Europe and, well, all over the world, bar America. And we've done America, but they you know, they didn't take to us. But no, we play 100 shows per year throughout Europe and Australia and everywhere. And we've slowed down a bit this year. We've only done about sort of 65 shows, 70 shows this year. So we're going to move into other areas, I think, in the near future. You know, I think we're going to start doing a bit more TV work if we can. And Francis and I particularly. And I think there's talk of another Aquostic album, because I'd like to do a lot more of the tracks.
Aquostically. I was going to ask you how to pronounce that. I'm glad you said that.
Yeah. And on the electric front, I don't know really what's going to happen with that. You can't keep on that trek round and round for much longer.
No.
So I'd like to do something a little bit different. If anything kind of pops its head up and we think, yeah, we'll have a go at that, we'll do it. But how much longer the electric show will last, I don't know, because we're getting a bit long in the tooth now, really, you know. And the show, I'm very tired as I speak to you now, because I only finished 2 days ago from the British tour. And I'm still a little bit busted up from it. And, you know, we've got a nice 4 or 5 month break now. And I'll get into my estate agency and get my suit on.
And
just see what life gives to me now.
Oh, good for
we'll
you.
We'll wait and see.
Good for you. Can't argue with that. Can't argue with that. Well, firstly, thank you for coming in. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Mine too.
Thank you, Lindsay, as well for coming in.
Oh, pleasure.
And could I just say on a personal level, thank you for providing years and years of great music.
Been a great pleasure.
What a heritage you have. And there are many guitarists around the world who wouldn't have picked up the guitar if you guys hadn't existed. So
that's very nice of you. It's been delightful.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you, Lindsay. All the best. Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas.
Weird saying it with the sun shining, but there we go.
Crackers or anything?
We've got tinsel. What more do you want? It's a radio station. Can't afford that.
Can't pull tinsel.
See you later. Cheers.
TRE, Talk Radio Europe.